அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் வணக்கம். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று டிவைன் லைஃப் பார்ட் டூ. மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகர் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். நவ் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
குட் மார்னிங். Originally, I thought we could do this chapter in two sessions. Now, I'm not sure whether it's three or four. On first reading, the chapter seems to be, to my impression was, it's a simple overview of what he has discussed. But the more times I read it, the more rich ideas I find in it, rich inspiration. So I thought we shouldn't rush to finish. We have come so far. Last time he told us that there is a self-existent reality that has become the universe. And this universe is an evolving universe. We don't see that self-existent reality today. We don't recognize it. We don't recognize it in ourselves, in other people, in the world around us, because it's an evolving, unfolding, progressive manifestation of that reality. And he says the nature of that reality is a divine perfection. It is freedom. It is absolute knowledge. It is absolute delight of existence. It's absolute power. It's harmony. It's fullness of being. And so many other ways in which it is the divine spirit. And he says, this evolution, this manifestation cannot stop until that self-existent being is fully manifested, fully revealed to itself. He says, the unknowable is discovering itself by manifesting itself. And so, for that reason, the ultimate goal and the ultimate end or culmination of all the evolution has to be a perfect life, a perfect existence. And he told us last time that that should express in two ways, consciousness and life. He says the two key words are consciousness and life. A divine life must be a life of a perfect consciousness and a perfect life. And he told us that definitely the life we have today and the consciousness we have today are not perfect. The consciousness we have today is the consciousness of mind and ego. The life we have today is a life of ignorance and separateness and strife and conflict and discord and suffering and death and incapacity and pain and ignorance, all of that. So this definitely cannot be the end of the evolution. We need a new consciousness and a new life. And he told us the first step, the first essential step for all spiritual progress, without which nothing else can be done and no life can ever be achieved, is? To go within. What you have said is certainly right. What he told in the chapter, actually, the words he said is to go within. So it raises a question. Why? We talked about last week how to go within. Many ways of going within. But why does he insist that nothing can be done without going within? That is the first primary goal of all spirituality, even if your goal is moksha, but most definitely when your goal is a divine life. Why should we go within? Anybody? Self-realization. Okay. We should go within for self-realization. Why is that so essential for a divine life? Because on surface it's partial. How is it partial, and why does that prevent us from having a divine life? Because we're in the ignorance. Because we're in an ignorance. Because as long as we're living in an ignorance and acting from an ignorance, the only result will be we'll create more ignorance. We're not going to create a perfect divine life acting out of ignorance. It's common sense. In what way are we ignorant? We're full of ego. Why does ego, what's the problem of ego? Why is ego an obstacle to a divine life? It's not the original. Whether it's the original or a duplicate or something. We forgot from where we came. Agreed. But why is that a main obstacle to a divine life? All we want is happiness. Huh? It separates us from the divine. How can we have a divine life when we're separate from the divine? So as long as we live in the ego, we think we're different from the divine. Does it separate us from anything else? It separates us from the divine. It separates us from other people. What about other people? It separates us from the divine in other people. How can we have a divine life if we're only relating to the ego in other people? Huh? As long as we're relating to the ego in other people, we're going to have a life of conflict. So it separates us from the divine. It separates us from the divine in other people. Anything else? Whoever said it, the first thing about self-realization, it separates us from the divine in ourselves. As long as I want to be important, as long as I want to be successful, as long as I want to rise above others, as long as my goal in life is my ego should develop, and I'm only thinking, see, I get something over other people, so I'm better off. No. As long as my goal is the progress or aggrandizement of my own ego, I'm missing the treasure. The treasure is the divinity in me. As long as this is what I want, how can I get that? As long as I'm seeking with every thought, with every action, with every feeling to boost up my ego, how can I become divine? If I really want the delight of existence, if I really want all the characteristics of the divine, I must drop this like a disease, like a hotcake. You can't get health by clinging to disease. So ego is on the surface. And as long as we are acting and trying to boost the ego, we are dividing ourselves from the divine. We're dividing ourselves from the divine in other people. We're dividing ourselves from the divine in ourselves. And a divine life can only be founded on unity. What unity? The unity between the soul in us and the soul in everyone else, the unity between the individual and the universal, and the transcendent. The divine life is unity. And he says in this chapter, three words. The first, divine life is unity. The second is, divine life is harmony. As long as we are in the ego, and as long as we're relating to the ego in other people, and we're very good at that, we see all the egoistic movements in other people and we want to correct them and criticize them and make them better and teach them and improve them, and we're very good at trying to improve other people. As long as we're seeing the ego in the other person, what's happening? Our ego is expanding. Each time I collect, you know that story, I've mentioned it, about that Swami in, who was in Pondicherry, I think he was a Kupu Swami. When Bharati was there, he used to go around the streets with a bag of garbage on his back. And Bharati came up to him and said, Swami, what are you doing? You're collecting all of these nasty things in garbage and carrying it on. What are you doing? It's very bad. He said, I'm doing it out here. You're doing it in that. The ego, you know what a gossip sheet is, a scandal sheet? The magazines and newspapers that go around collecting nasty gossip and scandals about people so that they can publish it? No. This is the ego. The ego is constantly looking very carefully to find out, oh, he made a mistake, oh, she did something, oh, she's not good, she's this, she's that. We're collecting all of that garbage and putting it on our back and wearing it like a silk gowns. As long as we're looking for that, thriving, oh, he made a mistake, I wouldn't have made that mistake. So I get puffed up and I put him, as long as we are in that game, as long as we do that, and it's very, very difficult, we know, not to do that. As long as we're doing that, where's divine life? Divine life is going in the other direction. We wonder why mother's not coming to us. We are collecting the garbage and wondering why it smells so bad around here. throw away the bag, you know? That's what the Swami, Kupu Swami, was trying to say. Get rid of your garbage and then there'll be a divine life. So we cannot have a divine life as long as we're trying to put down anybody or boost up ourselves. We can only have a divine life when our goal is harmony. Harmony with everybody. Harmony at every second. How difficult it is, we all know. To make harmony our main objective at every second in every moment. It robs us of all the joy of putting somebody down and criticizing them and quarreling with them and so forth. So harmony is the second term of the divine life. And the third term, he says in this chapter, is mutuality. What is mutuality? Mutuality means, say, life of the ego is everybody is here to do what I want. Everybody is here to help me become more successful, happier. Give me things, give me help, support me, give me affection, give me attention, give me anything. The whole world we look at around us, oh, there's a shop, what does it have for me? Not what does it have for other people. Oh, there's a new car. Oh, can I have it? Mutuality means we must take joy and fulfillment in everybody. The joy and delight and fullness and prosperity of everybody. Only when we really feel other people's joy, other people's prosperity, other people's accomplishment is our fulfillment, we cannot have mutuality and divine life will be going in the other direction. So, is there any other reason why we have to go inside? The surface is divided, the surface is ignorant, the surface is egoistic. There's another reason. Because he says there are two goals here. Perfect consciousness and perfect nature, perfect life. What is life? What does he mean by perfect life? Perfect consciousness, at least we can have some imagination. Yes, I must be filled with peace and joy and knowledge and strength and all. But what does he mean by perfect life? Our life is nature. Nature means our mind, our heart, our vital, our physical, are parts of nature. The consciousness is the soul. Our consciousness is the spirit. We have to have the consciousness of the spirit. But that's not enough. He's been telling us since page one that the goal of the whole evolution is not moksha. You can have a perfect consciousness, you can go to the super conscience. You leave life just as it is, a garbage heap. He says the goal is a divine life, which means not only a perfect consciousness, there must be a perfect nature. A perfect nature means our nature. What is our nature? Our body is part of nature. Our vital life is part of nature. Our mind is part of nature. They are not our us. They are the surface. The ego itself is part of nature. It's not our soul. It's not the spirit. So a perfect nature, a perfect life means our physical, vital, and mental have to be transformed. What is the position now? How much are we trying to, how do we transform our nature? Right now, if somebody says something that I don't like, I get angry. What am I doing? I'm not transforming my nature, I'm activating my nature. I am, every time, right now, we are not perfecting our nature, we are identified with our nature. You may say something, but I have a different opinion. My opinion is important to me. My opinion is not my soul. My opinion is my nature. I see things this way. When I say I see things this way, I don't mean I have a spiritual vision of reality. I mean my mind is looking at the world and it's constructing a world of ignorance, because the mind is an instrument of ignorance. And as long as I'm defending my opinion and saying I am right and you're wrong and please listen to me and don't interrupt me because I will clarify everything, I am essentially saying, allow my ignorant mind to lead my life and determine the nature, determine the world. As long as my feelings, my emotions, my preferences, my importance are important, and I am defending them against all my possessions, I'm defending against anything, my position, my pride, my prejudice, as long as I'm doing that, what am I doing, he says? I am energizing the ignorance of my own nature. Now we're identified with our nature. When you ask me how I am, I say, I'm angry. I'm angry means I am anger. I have become my nature. So in the tradition, and I've known it for thousands of years, if you want to, the first step is you have to step back from your nature. You have to detach from your nature. Why does Appa constantly talk about silent will? Because right now he can't say, stop willing. Who is willing? What is our will? Our will is of the mind, of the vital, and the body. I'm tired, I want to sit down. I'm hungry, I want to eat. I see something I want to buy. I want to be important. I'm curious, I want to learn something. That is the will, not of my soul. That's not the aspiration that you mentioned. The will, what we mean by will is the will of the mind, the will of most really the will of the vital, the will of the heart, and sometimes the will of the body. And as long as we are clinging to that and expressing it, we can't go inside. And as long as we don't go inside, the will of the ignorance is acting through us. So Appa doesn't say stop willing, because it's we might as well say stop breathing. Okay, let's all just stop breathing until we become divine. Because it's we're in the nature. So what he says is the first step. Don't express the will. When you don't express the will, it becomes more powerful. Oh, that's okay, because for the ego, if I can get more by not expressing, then I'm willing to do it. So the ego is willing. It's very difficult. I really want to ask, but okay, if I can get more, I will try and hold my breath for a little while and not will it. But by practicing the silent will, what really is happening is that we are slightly separating ourselves from the surface ignorance. We're separating ourselves so we go to a deeper level. We're going in within. Maybe it's just a half an inch below the surface, but we're going inside, which is the first step towards reaching the psychic. The deeper we go inside, the more we are free. The more we're no longer a slave to the automatic actions and reactions of our own nature. So we get a power over that nature. The real power we need is not how can I get power over somebody else. The real power mastery we need is to get mastery over our own nature. And we can't do that unless we separate from it. So why does Appa constantly talk about non-reaction? Because as long as I am reacting, I am energizing my nature. I'm stimulating my nature. Not only that, but even worse from my point of view is I'm energizing the nature of everybody else around me. I'm energizing the ego and the vitality and the anger and all the jealousy of everybody else. Well, I certainly don't want to do that. Even my ego doesn't want to do that. My ego doesn't want to give my energy to the other person like everybody who fights with Vale. I want all the energy for myself. So when Appa says don't react, because reaction will only increase the opposition and the problems for you, the ego says, oh, that's very good. That's a good idea. I'll try that. I will become more powerful. But the real thing that happens is I get a freedom from my own vitality. I get some freedom from my own reactions. How can we have a divine life as long as we're slave of our own ignorant, egoistic nature? The ego is not meant for immortality. The ego is not meant for delight of existence. The ego is a life of pain and suffering and success and failure and good fortune and misfortune, and for every pleasure there's a pain, and for every joy there's a suffering. If we want the divine life, we have to move from that surface, which is struggling all the time, competing all the time, to the depth where really the center is the delight of existence, the peace and delight. So when he says go within, and go within is the first step, it's really the first step. We have to move from an ignorant consciousness on the surface to the divine consciousness in the depths. We have to move from the ignorant nature inside so that our nature can be transformed. So in the second part of the chapter, he talks about these two things. What is the consciousness we should acquire? What is the perfect consciousness? That perfect consciousness is what he calls the Gnostic consciousness or the supermental consciousness. But he also says, we don't have to create that consciousness, it already exists. That consciousness is superconscient to us. What we call the superconscient is the perfect consciousness. The only problem is it's up there. We want it here. So we have to give up the human ignorant consciousness in order to make that consciousness, that super consciousness, our consciousness. When it becomes our consciousness, it's the Gnostic consciousness, we become the Gnostic being. So what is the character of that perfect consciousness? And he says, in order to get to the perfect consciousness, in going within, the first thing that happens is you go from the surface with all the tension, all the confusion, all the noise of the mind and the vital and everything. You go into a zone of silence. The entry into the inner country is the entry into silence. Peace, quiet. And he's described, and Mother has described, that that entry into the physical silence for one who's used to living on the surface where everything is movement and intention and excitement and intensity, if we are not really receptive, it seems like we're losing everything. Say, I can control that person by abusing them. Now you're asking me to be quiet. I feel helpless. I can get what I want by asking for it. Now you're telling me not to ask, to be silent. If I don't ask, I won't get anything. I go into a place which looks and feels like an emptiness, even a powerlessness. And when Sri Aurobindo gave that to Richard, when Mother came with Richard and Sri Aurobindo gave it, Richard said, I don't want this, please take it away. What takes 30, 40 years of extreme tapasya to get, he gave him in one day. He gave it to Richard, he gave it to Mother. Mother said from that first day it was there for him, for her, for the rest of her life. He ran away from it. That silence is Sri Aurobindo's silence. That silence is the grace to give us a freedom from our surface so we can go inside to reach that perfect consciousness. So what is that perfect consciousness? He tells us it has five characteristics. How can we know whether we have reached the perfect consciousness? He said, first of all, as long as we're in the human consciousness, we can never have full mastery of anything, and we can never have knowledge of it, full knowledge of anything. The first step into that perfect consciousness is self-knowledge. We know ourselves. We know ourselves to be infinite and eternal. We know that this is not our only life, that our life is not ourselves, our ego is not ourself. We are a spiritual being. We have been evolving for so long. We will live eternally. Our consciousness never ends, no matter how many times we die. We know the eternal being in ourselves. We know the psychic. He says, to be fully is to be fully conscious. We have to be fully conscious of the truth of our own being. And that is not just to know the divinity of ourselves. We have to equally know the divinity of every other person and everything in order to be fully conscious. He says, until we reach that perfect consciousness, we'll always be subject to failures. And as I think you know, and he has said, why is it, have you ever thought, why is it that most of our progress comes through failure? Of course, we enjoy the successes, it's true. But most of the real progress we make comes through the difficulties we have, the failures we have. In the story, it's very clear. All Darcy's progress only comes because of his failures. Because he made that foolish mistake of calling her tolerable. And then he went and proposed to her, and he made that very foolish mistake of thinking and assuming that she will readily marry him. And even when he spoke things that got him deeper and deeper into trouble with her, until she abused him so much. The greatest success of the family came when Collins went away from the family and married Charlotte. The great success of the family came because Lydia eloped with Wickham and made Darcy intervene. All the progress in the story started as failures, Mr. Bennett sending Lydia to Brighton and all. And that's true for us too. Why? Because we're acting in the ignorance. We're acting in an ignorant consciousness. And as long as we're acting in an ignorant consciousness, we need something to tell us and wake us up and say, don't continue doing this. You can go on doing this for 100 more or 1,000 more lives, and you're going to be in the same place. Your progress comes from giving up action in the ignorance, seeking the knowledge, seeking the consciousness, going within. So every failure is a reminder to us, and an encouragement to us to not to repeat the old mistakes over and over again, but to try to find the truth and act from that truth. And he says the second characteristic of this super conscience, this Gnostic consciousness which is there within us, is power. Power is the one thing we all want. Again, even if we... What is going to come? Results. Huh? Even if we don't learn from the failure, will we get the results? You'll get the results of ignorance. No? What we're supposed to get failure are not the results of failure. We're supposed to get knowledge. When we get the knowledge, we get the results of knowledge. Yes. Your question is, when we don't learn from the failure, what are the results we get? The immediate results of what we get may be exactly what the ego wants. Maybe the exactly. I go, if I'm a corrupt officer, I ask for a bribe and I get the bribe and I feel gratified. You see, it worked. I could have worked for a year and not got this much pay. I got it in one transaction. This is better. He succeeds. Of course, that's not learning from failure. That's acting on his immediate success. Supposing he gets caught doing something, and he says, yes, I was foolish this time. I must be more clever next time. He doesn't learn from the failure. He goes on repeating it and tries to do it better and better in the wrong way until eventually something worse happens. Everything that, nothing that happens to us is a punishment. Everything that happens to us is trying to encourage us to shift from the wrong thing to the right thing, from the ignorant thing to the true thing, from the egoistic, selfish thing to that which will give us power. Power, real power. For the ego, power is what it can take. And it feels the power of falsehood. If I tell a lie and I get what I want, oh, I'm very powerful. It feels the power of the thief. It feels the power of selfishness. Everybody else is foolish, but I will take everything I can get. But that power, the results that we get from the ego are always a success coming with failure, joy coming with suffering, a pleasure that's followed by pain, and so forth. That's not the divine life. The divine life is a life where suffering, failure, pain, death itself don't exist. That power can come only when we get to the true consciousness. When we get the true consciousness, we get a power. Not a power to dominate over everybody else. A power to have a divine life for ourselves and everybody else. Because all power really is based on the consciousness. All power is a result of the consciousness. When we act out of when we have a low consciousness, the power we get can never give us the fruits of a divine life, the fruits of eternal joy, harmony, and mutuality, which is the divine life. So the consciousness we want is not the consciousness of the ego that's competing with everybody else, that's not looking out for itself. The consciousness we want is the consciousness that knows what Mother wants for us, that knows the divine will, that wants what the divine wants for us. And the divine, what does the divine want for us? The divine wants for us a divine life. Because the divine life is the expression of the divine in us. So wanting what Mother wants, wanting what the divine wants, is to want to be in a divine life for ourselves. And that divine life is the life where we have the power to get anything we want. But the only thing we'll want is what the divine wants. The only thing we will get is what is the joy, is what is fulfillment, is what is power of accomplishment. We can accomplish anything we want to accomplish because we've given up the ignorant will of the ego and identified with the true will of our soul, which is the divine will, and we have a power that can accomplish anything. But everything it accomplishes will be divine. Everything will be based on unity, mute harmony, and mutuality. And we've all seen that power, not once or twice. We've all seen that power whenever we've run into a problem and we've seriously consecrated it. And how many stories you have heard here from each other and how many Appa has told you, it's in the thousands. We know that power is real. Last month sometime, I don't remember the day now, in the MSS office in Pondicherry, Sri Vidya had some important work she wanted to finish. I think she had to take leave. I don't remember the circumstances, but she very, very important work she wanted to finish, and suddenly the EB department announced that full day power cut for maintenance work. Full day power cut. She said, no, I have to finish this work, full day power cut. Mother, please help me. I have to do this work today. throughout the whole day. There was power cut all through the town. There was power cut all in the community. There was power cut next door. There was no power cut in the MSS office. In the evening, she met with Ashok, and she mentioned that there was no power cut. I said, what? No power? How is that possible? There was power cut in the next house. We had power cut. How is it you didn't have power cut? And he got very curious, so he called the EB department. They called the EB department, and they said, how is it, what happened with the power cut in Venkatnagar and all the surrounding areas? Yes, yes, full power cut all day, as we announced. No, 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 in our office, we didn't have power cut. You know what they said? That's impossible. That's impossible. We have all seen that power, and we've all seen that impossibility. For a moment here and a moment there, at a critical moment. And what is it? What's the secret of unleashing that power? At that moment, we shift from the surface ignorant ego consciousness. We go as deep as we can. We pray or consecrate or call as deeply as we can. And in that measure, we move to the true consciousness, to a center of Gnostic consciousness. In us. We may be just thinking of Mother, imagining Mother, surrendering to Mother, calling her, whatever it is. Mother is that Gnostic consciousness. She is the supramental consciousness. One touch of it in one instant expresses as power. So the Gnostic consciousness is pure power. Pure power to do anything. But of course, only anything, it will only do anything divine, it will only do anything good, it will only do something that is creating a divine life. So we can very well know whether we're in the right true consciousness or not. No sense saying, I am all right, everything's all right with me, I am fine and I'm sincere, but everything's going wrong outside. That's not possible. When we are in the true consciousness, there'll be power even if there's no grid. And you've all seen it, and if you think back over your own experiences and all the stories Appa's experiences, they're all not stories, they're all real experiences, and all that you hear here, and try to understand, you'll see, yes, the divine consciousness means power. Means perfect power to get any result. Then, well, it's difficult, we say. It's very difficult to get the results of the divine power by being on the surface, by insisting on my ego or my prestige or my preferences or my ignorance. It is not very difficult when we say, I want to throw away the garbage and all, and I want to rush inside, and I want to be in the true consciousness. That's what Mother calls sincerity. We've all done it many times. We can all think back to those times when something remarkable happened because we took that effort. And at that moment, it was not our power, it was not our mental power or our vital power or our physical capacity that expressed. It was a supramental power. It was Mother's power. It was grace. It was very right to call it grace. So that's why going within is so important, and that's why how powerful that consciousness is. That consciousness is all powerful. That's the second characteristic of the supramental consciousness. That's what he wants for us. That's why they've come here. That's the divine life. The third is, it's a consciousness of delight. For that consciousness, everything is delight. Every touch, every event. And that delight doesn't depend on what happens. It's self-existent. It's automatic. It's there at every moment, regardless of what's happening. We live in a complete and total non-stop experience of delight. And he says in this chapter, it's impossible for us to imagine this, because for us, our life is a variation between a little joy here and a little pain there and a lot of neutrality and emptiness and boredom or just indifference or in between. It's impossible for us to imagine. Even if we try to imagine nonstop delight, something in us will say, nonstop delight, it sounds a little boring. Because for us, anything that's continuous, the vital wants intensity, it wants variation in everything. We cannot imagine a life where every moment there is an intense, ecstatic delight, and not a boring delight of always the same thing. Everything gives a delight. Everything that happens reveals its delight. And that delight is showing itself in an infinitely varying ways. Through each person you see is revealing something you never knew before. Through each event, through each simple act, even if it's combing the hair or brushing the teeth or drinking water, through everything that delight shows itself. So we can know when we're in the divine consciousness, when we're in that consciousness, when there is a delight regardless of the circumstances. I think I mentioned it once, the most intense experience I had of that delight was on a train going to Hyderabad overnight. At a time, sleeping on the train is not my idea of heaven on earth. But I really felt like I was on heaven and earth, and it wasn't because of the train. But when that delight comes, it can come anywhere, under any circumstance. The fourth characteristic of that superconscience is universality. To be in that true consciousness is not to be limited to the ego. It's not to be caught up and locked up in our ego, or in our body, or in our vital, or in our mind. It is really to be, to live universally, and to know our oneness and unity with everything in the world. He says, it's to live in all beings. Imagine living in everyone, experiencing, living in everyone's joys, living in everyone's accomplishments, living in everyone's fullness. And he says the step, the first step to going there, how does the ego live? The ego tries to live entirely for itself. Itself and a few people around, because they're part of ourself. The consciousness, the true consciousness is the consciousness which Appa calls consciousness responsibility. It lives for everybody. It lives for the fulfillment of everybody. When a great leader like Mahatma Gandhi works for the freedom of the country, he's not working for his own achievement. He's working for the achievement of the country. He lives in the joy of Indian freedom. When Churchill fought World War II and said, "We will never surrender," he didn't say, "I will never surrender." He spoke on behalf of the whole country. He identified with the country. He lived for the country. When Appa started Mother Estates and started development in Ramapuram, it was not his development that he was trying to bring about. He had a deep aspiration for the development of India. And therefore, what he did in one tiny village in India spread to the whole country. In 10 years, it reached more than 100,000 villages. And he delights, even today he delights, every time he hears any news about any sign of prosperity or progress of anybody in India, it's true elsewhere also, but he just expands, because for him, Indian prosperity is his delight, his fulfillment. So Sri Aurobindo describes it in Savitri when he says, the whole world could take refuge in her single heart. That's universality. And Mother's sense of consciousness responsibility, you know it, she said, if a soul comes to me for a moment, once, I take responsibility for their spiritual destiny from then on. That's consciousness responsibility. That is, when we have that, then we know we're really in the true consciousness. We're in the Gnostic consciousness. But there's something more. To really be in that true consciousness, we must know we're not limited to the life, we're not limited to the body, we're not limited to the world. There is in us, the truth of our being is something transcendent. It's bigger than the universe. It doesn't depend on the manifestation. Sri Aurobindo said, the universe may end, life will not end. Our life will not end. Our existence will not end. Our existence doesn't depend even on the, let alone on the body, let alone on the earth. It doesn't even depend on the universe. Because the truth of our existence transcends all manifestation. It is a transcendent eternal. And to be in the Gnostic consciousness is to know that as the truth of our being. It's one thing we say there is a transcendent that's eternal up there. That's different. What's that got to do with me? It's another thing. Yes, that's very nice. He's lucky. He never has anything to worry about. The truth is, that's us. The truth is to know we are that. We live in the universe. We live beyond the universe. And we are eternal. We are infinite. And he says, only when you know that you are transcendent, your life will really be full. Really full. You will really be free. Because there's nothing you can ever lose. Freedom means you're free from any fear, you're free from any loss, you're free. You can never be confined in anything. That is the truth of our being. That is the truth of the self-existent being which has become you, each of us, and the world. It is fullness and freedom. And until we know that we are that eternal and infinite fullness and freedom, we don't know the truth of our own being. That's the truth of our own being that we need to know in order to live the divine life. That's what he meant by consciousness must become perfect. This is the perfection of our consciousness, not somebody else's consciousness. Each of us has the destiny to reach that perfect consciousness, to know this fullness, this freedom, this power, this delight, this universality and transcendence. And that is the basis for the divine life. But that's not all. He's been telling us since book one, and I've tried to, and I think I've mentioned this before, I tried to imagine by an analogy, because Appa has taught me that the Indian way of thinking through analogy is so powerful. So I was trying to figure out what analogy I could use to understand, to develop this divine consciousness. And I think I mentioned it in one of the earlier meetings, but I'll do it again because I thought it so helpful. For Darcy or Elizabeth, let's say, for Elizabeth to really know the true Gnostic consciousness, what would it mean? Obviously, she has to know that she's not the prejudiced girl who's feeling inferior because her mother comes from the middle class. She must be free from that ignorance and all the ignorance of that. She's a good girl. She's not a selfish girl. She really wants the joy and fulfillment of Jane. She's not quite so concerned about Mary and Lydia and Kitty. With her mother, she'll be happy if her mother leaves her alone. With people like Carolyn, she'll be glad if she never sees them again. She definitely doesn't have a universal joy in everybody's fulfillment. When Carolyn comes to the ball wearing a nice fancy dress and looking very important, she doesn't feel happy about that. She shrinks and feels a little sorry. She lives in herself. If she could live and joy in every, at least as much as she takes the joy in Jane's success, we can understand that would be a huge progress for her. That would be, we can say, to universalize, but that would not be the Gnostic consciousness. She would have to conceive that the truth of her existence is not the Elizabeth Bennet in this story at all. She's not confined to this story at all. She's been through so many stories. She's been through so many stories in the past, and she'll be in so many stories in the future. There's no death for her. She's already immortal. Her soul has been going from one to the other and will continue to go from one to the other and will grow in stature with each story, unless she knows that she's bigger than the life that she leads. She's not in the Gnostic consciousness. So she can learn that she's immortal. Immortal in the sense she can never die, because she'll always go on. And if it's not this one, it's not that one. But that's not what Sri Aurobindo means by immortality. Not means that you're a succession of lives, and so when one is over, you get another one. If one job is over, you get another job, and you'll be always employed. Not like that. You don't depend on a job for, you don't depend on a life for your existence. You are beyond all lives. You live immortally, eternally, even when you're not in a life. She would have to understand that she's outside the stories. She's somebody who lives beyond all the stories in which she lives. She exists outside those stories, transcendent of those stories. But that still wouldn't be the full Gnostic consciousness. She would have to realize she's the creator of all the stories that she lives in. She's the creator of all the characters and people and all the events in all of those stories. She is Jane Austen. What is the distance from Elizabeth Bennet being one member of the five girls in the family, quarreling and trying to struggle through the difficulties of life with all the suffering and all the pain and all the ignorance and all the confusion and strife and everything, with the, on all sides, to know that everything that happens to her is the will of her own divine being. She is the creator. She is the writer. She is the author. She is eternal and infinite and lives in the fullness. And she takes delight of existence in everything that happens in every story and without and beyond all stories. That's how far we have to go from our present consciousness to really know the Gnostic consciousness. It's an analogy, but for me it's really helpful, because it's not enough she comes to terms with all the people around her, or remembers her past births, or dreams of her future births. It's something way beyond that. So when he says that the Gnostic consciousness is totally surrendered to the divine and wants only what the divine wants, it's another way of saying it wants what the truth of its own being wills all the time. She wants to be what Jane Austen wants her to be, not what her mother wants her to be by marrying Collins, not what she wants her vital wants her to be by marrying Wickham, not what Carolyn wants her to be by becoming an old maid, or what anybody else wants her to be, or what any part of her wants to be. She wants to be what the supreme being, that self-existent reality, is trying to manifest in her. Because that's the truth of our being. Our truth of our being is the divine wanting to manifest its highest potential and greatest delight in and through each of us. Yes. You're asking if she rises to the consciousness of Jane Austen, will react. Once more. If Elizabeth realizes the supramental consciousness, yes. Yes. What will be the role of Carolyn Bingley in her life or in the story? It's a good question, because for each of us, think about what's the role of everybody else in our life. I once wrote an article for Consecration Magazine. It was a humorous art. I was trying to be humorous, but I was making fun of myself and making fun of the ego. I wrote about the ego is the superstar in every movie, and everybody else is a character. I'm the superstar in everything that happens. And everybody else is a character, a supporting cast in my story. The divine is the supporting cast. The divine is there trying to manifest itself equally in Carolyn Bingley. I agree, she's quite disguised there. It's a good disguise. Equally in Wickham, equally in Lydia and everybody else. The divine is trying to manifest not through the fulfillment of Elizabeth Bennet. The divine wants all the characters to realize they are Jane Austen and become the creative authors of a divine life. We can't, it's not enough, and he says it in the chapter, it comes later, but you bring it here. He says a divine life doesn't mean that I reached the Gnostic consciousness and now life is divine. Divine life means at least there must be a community of people. And the goal should be that it becomes more and more widespread. There still may be human beings, because humanity is a path of the ascent in consciousness. But the destiny is that however it starts, it may start with a few. Sri Aurobindo said 10 or 100. It may start with a few, but the goal, it will not end until the Gnostic being is there everywhere. The Gnostic community becomes like humanity is today, the next species. We may go through a transition. So obviously, when Elizabeth reaches that Gnostic consciousness, She doesn't need the prodding of Carolyn Bingley for her progress, no? But what he says, and I'm skipping ahead because your question's a very perceptive question, but the fact that one person, Elizabeth Bennett, reaches the Gnostic consciousness, or Darcy, or whoever it is, changes the atmosphere for everybody around them. So, you know, the truth of the matter is that all of us have a good side or a better side. We don't have, and a worse side. And sometimes we say, I don't know what it is, that person brings out the worst in me. Mother brings out the best in everybody. It doesn't mean we're best. We feel like we're angels when we're with Mother because she brings out the best in her atmosphere. Then we go back and other people are not quite as satisfied. But each who reaches that elevates the atmosphere and brings out the better part of everybody they're in relation to. The same way we say, if I don't react to somebody's reaction, if I react to them, I energize their ignorance and their falsehood. If I don't react, I don't energize that. I give them an opportunity to make a progress. I want them to make a progress by following my instructions and agreeing that they're all wrong. That never works. If I really want them to make a progress, I can help them make a progress by not reacting and energizing that in them so that they have freedom to make a progress. So the more each soul becomes free, the more we reach the supramental consciousness, the more opportunity we give to everybody else and support we give to everybody else. And this is the process he describes later in the chapter, that will start and gradually spread not only to the cream of humanity, it will gradually spread to all of the lower levels of humanity and even to lower levels of life beyond that. The Gnostic principle, the Gnostic atmosphere, the supramental consciousness will change. He said, even for those who haven't taken to a spiritual life, war itself will be abolished. Many forms of violence and suffering and strife that are common today will simply disappear, even though there very few people have really become Gnostic beings or supramental beings. But it will be the first step towards the divine life. So this is the consciousness that creates unity, harmony, and mutuality, because we feel oneness with everybody. We're not trying to construct that oneness. When we're on the surface, as long as we're on the surface, if we want harmony, we mean, all right, let's get together, let's make agreement, let's make compromises, we'll make some rules. We, if it's for a center, we open at this time, we close at that time, you do this, I'll do that, here are the rules, we don't talk during in the, this place, and we have a harm, oh yes, everything is peaceful and harmonious. This is all mental construction. We may be able to create some semblance of a harmony in the mother center between 7 in the morning and 8 at night, and so forth, at least some approximation, but it's only the mental construction. Harmony cannot be achieved through rules. Harmony cannot be achieved through a set of laws. That may be better than chaos. We're happy for the laws of traffic on the street, even though it's still a chaos, no? But it can never be done. The harmony he's talking about can only be achieved by reaching the Gnostic consciousness, inside, reaching the true consciousness. It can't be built. It can't be constructed. It can't be organized. And this is a very important message that I didn't realize was there in the chapter until later. He said, what humanity's been doing, we have been trying to construct a perfect life from the ego, from the mind, from the surface. And what we've done is we've created so many laws, government apparatus, so many institutions of all types, educational institutions, financial institutions, hospital medical institutions. It's all a structure on the surface done by the ignorant consciousness. And Sri Aurobindo wrote 100 years ago that this effort to reach perfection outwardly, it has led to 2 world wars. We still have massive poverty in the world. We have pollution that's destroying the environment. We have so many types of problems. He says, the result is we have created such a structure, such a complex, complicated, unmanageable structure in our effort. In some countries, we've done it through totalitarian rule, whether it's the rule of the clerics or the rule of the military or a religious party. We've tried all different types of trying to get that harmony outside, mostly by suppressing the individual, mostly by making everybody the same. We have an educational system in India that destroys individuality. It destroys thinking because we want everybody to be educated. We're not educating people. We're getting people degrees. We're killing the mental capacities of the people. That's how mind works. So the solution doesn't lie in the external. It only can be done. And he says humanity is reaching a crisis point where either we make a progress in consciousness to solve these problems, or this huge edifice of complication that we've created will crush us and the whole thing will collapse. He wrote it 100 years ago. After that, there were 2 world wars that were a sign of it. So all our faith in the external methods won't work. The only thing that will really work is we have to go within and get to that center of unity, harmony, and mutuality that makes us one with others. Our harmony comes not through a compromise, not just by adjusting with other people. It comes through a real consciousness of being united with them. Our goal is a divine life and a perfect life, and I said earlier, and he said earlier, that means our nature must be perfect. What is our nature now? Our nature as its best is mental nature. If the animal lives primarily in the vital, man at his highest, we live in the mental nature and we try to rule our lives by mind. And all the problems we have, we see the achievements of mind. We certainly have progressed far beyond the arboreal ape. We've certainly made a great progress in technology and in life from the animal. But we have not eliminated strife, we've not eliminated suffering, we've not eliminated disease, we've not eliminated competition, we've not eliminated falsehood, we've not eliminated disharmonies even from within our family, let alone or in our homes or in our communities or in our nations. We're full of competition and discord, and we've not even eliminated it in ourselves. Because the mental consciousness is not capable even of being harmonious with itself. Our mind is wanting things that are contradictory. Our mind is quarreling with the vital all the time, like we see in Darcy. Our physical, vital, and mental all want different things. So as long as we are in this human nature, there's no hope for unity, even if we have the divine consciousness behind, unless we change the nature. We may have the peace of moksha, but we will never have the perfect life and delight of existence, which only comes when our nature becomes supernature. And what is that supernature? It's the supramental power. It's the supramental being. So when Sri Aurobindo talks about the human being becoming the supermental being, he means our consciousness, human consciousness becoming the supermental consciousness, and our human nature becoming transformed into the supermental nature, or the supernature, or you might say mother's nature, because she is that supermental nature. Her power is that of the supermental nature. And one of the characteristics of that supermental nature is that knowledge and will become unified, that what we know and what we can accomplish, that our awareness and our power are no longer separate from each other. This is a topic we've discussed earlier, you know. In mind, I may know how to do something, I may not be able to do it. I may want to do something, I may not know how to do it. I may be a great coach for tennis players, but I may not be able to play the tennis. Or I may be a great tennis player, but I don't know how to teach another person because I don't know. I only can do it. I don't have the knowledge of it. This is mind. Very often, we want something, but we don't know how to achieve it. Or we say, I understand everything that Mother says, everything Appa has written, I agree with it, I accept it, but it's not happening. It's not happening because the will is separate from the knowledge. The supernature, in the supernature, knowledge, in the supermental consciousness, knowledge and will are one. They're no longer separate. If we have the knowledge, we have the power. In fact, he says the very act of knowing something is an act of power. So if I know something, the supermental changes the world by its knowing it. They're not separate thing. They're not two things anymore. So this is the supernature. It has the knowledge of the superconscious, and everything it knows, it has the power to spontaneously express, spontaneously realize. Whatever it wants to realize, it can realize. And that's why when somebody asked Sri Aurobindo, is it true that Mother has the power to supermentalize the world in a day? He said yes. She has that power, but she also knew that that's not sanctioned, that this is not the time, that humanity was not ready for that to get the results that should be brought. So when we have that consciousness, whatever is sanctioned, whatever sanctioned by the divine, whatever is the aspiration of our soul, it will be instantaneously realized. It doesn't take time. It doesn't take effort. Which means, it's very important, because all of us know the frustration of wanting something but feeling we don't have the power to do it. It may be you want your child to be happy, but you don't have the power to make them happy. Or you want them to study, or you want a family to stop quarreling, or whatever else it is. But we don't have the power. But here he's giving us the formula. If you want the power, raise the consciousness. We think what we lack is the power. What we really lack is the consciousness. We're trying to do something on the surface by exercising our authority or exercising our persuasion or exercising our affection or physically working, when the real thing we need to have the power is to go within and raise the consciousness. For us, the problem is out there. The power we think is out there. The real power comes from going within. And he explains how. Yes, yes. Yes. Don't worrying is definitely better than worrying. Worrying. Because some people won't be able to hear what you're saying, so I will try to restate. I'll see if I can restate your question so everybody will understand my response. When we're trying to help other people, like our children or something like that, and they make a mistake or they get in trouble, should we tell them, don't worry, mother is there, or should we try to help them correct the error in their consciousness? No? The real answer to this is we should ask ourselves, she knows the answer. The real question, the thing that we should say is, what can I do? How, as the parent or the family member, should I change my consciousness? Because my power to help my child depends not on what I say, but on my consciousness. And in the measure of my consciousness, I've already helped my child. If I have become a devotee of mother, in that measure, they are already benefiting. So what more can I do? In other words, and then you can ask the question, what should be your advice to yourself? Just like you posed for the child, where can I correct myself? Correcting ourselves is wonderful, but it's, at best, it's concentrating on the problem. And I said last time, and Appa's emphasizing a lot recently, that the more we concentrate on the problem, the more we tend to energize it. When we say we're going to consecrate our problem, what we mostly do is we concentrate on the problem and energize it. So, therefore, you gave two alternatives to should I try to correct, help them make, encourage them to correct their mistakes, or should I ask them to rely on mother? When you shift and rely on mother, you energize your relationship with mother. When you correct your mistakes, you purify the ignorance. Both are good, but sometimes we energize the ignorance rather than purify it. Even then it eventually gets purified because there is mother in the background, but that's why Appa has always said it's not necessary to know what's wrong in order to set it right. It's not necessary to confess all our sins to mother in order to be purified. It's enough if we give ourselves to mother. If you give yourself, it's not necessary that the Swami takes the bag of garbage off his head and takes each thing and throws it away. And, oh, I don't want this and I don't want that. He can simply drop everything and call mother. So I'm not saying, in some cases one method is very helpful and both methods have their value and we can do both. But in the measure we can really go to mother, really cling to mother, not saying, mother, I'm perfectly all right, I don't know why things are going wrong. I'm innocent, I've perfectly done everything. Not that way. The more we can really rely on her, really give ourselves to her, really mean it when we say, thy will be done and not my will, really consecrate the whole thing to her. We need not clean the garbage bag, because it will be washed away, it will be cleansed instead. So in practice, both methods have a value. But our power to influence others, he's given us the formula, our power to influence others is directly proportionate to our capacity to reach the true consciousness in ourselves. And if we feel powerless, we're all limited. No soul has the full power over another soul, because each soul is the divine and is given that freedom. No soul has that complete power, but every soul has potentially the complete power to seek the true consciousness in itself. And in the measure we find it, that influence on others can be extremely great, as Appa's influence has been on for all of us. Very good question. So you see where we are in the chapter? We went within to reach the pure super conscience and make that our consciousness, and now he tells us there's the second step of transforming our nature, which he's already described to us in earlier chapters, but he's giving us the whole picture now. Why it's not enough we reach the pure consciousness, we have to transform our nature too and make it the supramental nature, make it mother's will, make it mother's force, make it mother's light, make it mother's consciousness that acts in us and through us. And we do that not by asserting ourselves, but by consecrating and surrendering. And in the measure, it's the supramental, it's mother's consciousness that acts in us. Life becomes perfect. Consciousness becomes perfect, and life becomes perfect. We've all seen it in so many different ways, not as the ultimate divine life, but when a problem became an opportunity, or an illness disappeared, or a debt disappeared, or whatever it is. We've all seen that power in the measure we go within and sincerely consecrate our external nature. We've seen Mother's power act in life. This is the same principle that goes all the way until life is divine. It's the same principle and it's the same process, but it's going to go much further. And when it's complete, the power of the Gnostic being, the power of each individual that's manifesting that Gnostic consciousness will be so great, we'll have power not only over our mind, not only over life, but even over matter, even over material existence. This consciousness has power. The spiritual consciousness will transform matter and reveal even matter as Satchidananda. So the Gnostic being, because remember, his characteristic of the divine life is immortality. Not immortality of the soul from one birth to another. If the soul wants to live in a body immortally, the body itself will be immortal. It's up to the soul for decision. There'll be not only no suffering, not only no pain, not only no failure, not only no ignorance, there'll be no death. If you want to leave, you leave. If you want to change, you change. But death doesn't exist anymore. That power is there. So when we talk about power, he's not talking about the power of over the spouse, or the power to get money, or the power in the workplace, or the power to become a political leader. He's talking ultimately about the power over death itself. because that's the truth, and that's the message of Savitri, that even death is only a power of the divine, necessary for us to make a progress, necessary as a failure. It's not a failure, it's a transition, a constant reminder for us to keep making progress. Till we don't need it anymore, and as soon as you reach the supramental consciousness, you don't need the progress of death anymore, you don't need the progress of suffering or failure or any such thing anymore, it doesn't exist for you. So when he's talking about power, it really means unlimited power, unqualified power, power to be anything and do anything you want. And therefore, he says, when that happens, man will make the most momentous discovery possible. The most momentous discovery. We will not only have power over our thoughts, over our relationships, over our harmony and everything, we will even have power over material existence, of which we feel helpless now. It's completely under out of our control. And that only then, only when death itself disappears, the true supramental power is fully manifest, and we have really, the Gnostic being has really become the supramental being. And he says, I'm going to end it here, the Gnostic being is in unison and communion with the consciousness force at the root of everything. There is a consciousness force at the root of everything, at the root not only of our life, our mind, the material world, the earth, the universe itself. The Gnostic consciousness will be in unison and communion with that force. We know what happens if we have a direct line to the Neyveli power plant. We shouldn't have a problem for electricity in our house. If we have a connection to the internet, we have access to all the information that the world has. If we're the owner of the bank or of the central bank, cash is not a problem for us. What can be your problem when you have a direct link to the consciousness force that's at the root of everything? What is that consciousness force? It's the force of Satchidananda. It's the supramental force. It's mother's force. So this is what he means by the divine life. And that will be a life of perfect harmony, perfect mutuality, perfect unity. But as he stresses often, it won't be of boredom or sameness or everything. It will be a life in which every moment and every experience will be an ecstatic, original, creative manifestation of the delight of existence in an infinite number of ways.